is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, the Republicans really desperately want a war. And they really desperately want this war. Oh, by the way, let me just start out here. Thank you to the folks at 91.3 FM KBCS for this sweet card. This is one of our Pacifica stations, and a lot of folks signed this. This is great. Happy Valentine's Day card. And thank you. It's really sweet, and we really appreciate it. And it's great having, you know, listener-supported stations and all that kind of thing. Thank you. Anyway, so here's the Republicans are really, really angry. And Fox News in particular, although right-wing hate radio is doing a spectacular job of this, of trashing the president because he will not give legitimacy to ISIS and any of these other right-wing whack jobs who claim to be doing what they're doing in the name of Islam. This is, you know, very wise on the part of Obama. And by the way, this was the policy that George W. Bush took as well. He said, we're not going to kill our way to victory, which was what the State Department spokeswoman said a couple of day before yesterday. He said, and essentially what President Obama said, he said, this is our battle is not with Islam, George W. Bush said. Barack Obama said the same thing. But you've got Bill O'Reilly out there. You got all these right wingers. These people who are either stupid, I'm lacking a word. They're either so ignorant of how foreign policy and relations between nations and all this kind of stuff. They're either so ignorant about that stuff that they're just making stupid comments. You know, Bill O'Reilly saying, "Hey, we got a holy war here. President won't call it that, but it's a holy war." I mean, that's a stupid thing to say. But it goes beyond stupid because I don't believe that Bill O'Reilly's that stupid. I don't believe Roger Ailes is that stupid. I don't believe that the people at Fox News, I don't believe Sean Hannity's that stupid. Which means that these right wingers, let me just back up a little bit and set this thing up. ISIS is somewhere between 15 and 50,000 people now in the Middle East. Just like when we first attacked al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in 2001, shortly after 9/11, George W. Bush went in. They were fewer than 5,000 people. In fact, there were some estimates that there were only a few hundred really hardcore supporters of al-Qaeda, and the rest of them were people who just were there to go through the training camp. It was like summer camp or, you know, basic training for whatever. So it's a small group of people who have been largely marginalized by their own people, by their own tribes, their own culture, their own society, and frankly, their own religion. And they claim that what they're doing is being done the way that the Prophet Muhammad would want it done, the way that the Quran says it should be done, the way that hundreds of years of Islam, whatever, you know, say it should be done. But it's a claim that in the region, everybody knows is a lie. I mean, this is a largely Muslim region, and these people look around and go, this isn't any Islam that we've ever seen, what ISIS is doing. I mean, even Saudi Arabia, the most hard right of all the right-wing dictatorships in the Middle East that is an officially Muslim state, doesn't, you know, put people in cages and set them on fire with gasoline. They do behead people, but they give them due process first. I mean, we essentially do the same thing in the United States. We have a death penalty here as well. But it's a state-administered death penalty. Now, ISIS would argue, hey, we're a state. And we're doing the Islamic thing. And the president of the United States, President Obama, gets this. And he says, no, you are not a state, A, and you are not Muslim. And I'm not going to legitimize you guys, ISIS, we're not going to make you seem legitimate by calling you Muslims. And then all the Sturm und Drang comes. So the question, if the guys on the Reich know that by calling the Islamic State Muslim fundamentalists, Muslim terrorists, if they know that calling them that gives them exactly what they want and increases their legitimacy, not just there, but all around the world, increases the probability that some young person someplace is going to say, oh, yeah, I'm a Muslim, too. I guess I'll go join ISIS because, you know, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, John McCain, these guys all say that ISIS is Muslim. So if you're going to be a good Muslim, you must join ISIS. Right. Either these guys on the right, on the hard right in the United States are so stupid that they don't understand this simple dynamic, which I think is extremely unlikely. Or they are so motivated by malice and hatred of President Barack Obama that they are willing to damage their own country by going out and saying this kind of stuff. And I mean, here's a what you really want to know where this is coming from. What's going on? Consider this. First of all, a couple of comments that President Obama made by way of pointing out we are not at war with Islam. We're at war with a bunch of whack jobs who keep trying to justify what they're doing with by Islam. It's like the abortion murderers. They run around playing super Christians. Yeah, I'm a super Christian. I'm going to go kill an abortion doctor. Well, most Christians look at that and go, Jesus never said go kill abortion doctors. I mean, his first law was, you know, love everybody like yourself and love God. That's a very different thing than go kill somebody. So we don't refer to Eric Rudolph as a Christian terrorist because it would diminish Christianity and it would enhance Eric Rudolph. So why do these guys, you know, the guy who blew up the both an abortion clinic, a gay bar, and the Olympics in Atlanta. So if we don't do that, why would we want to do this with Muslims? The president said, quote, just as leaders like myself reject the notion that terrorists like ISIL genuinely represent Islam, Muslim leaders need to do more to discredit the notion that our nations are determined to suppress Islam. Well, it's kind of hard to tell the world you're not determined to suppress Islam when your TV commentators and your radio commentators and your bloggers are all saying, hey, that's the name of the game. So anyhow, I said, you know, you want to know where this is coming from. Rudy Giuliani is like the id of the Republican Party, right? In early Freudian thought, Sigmund Freud, back in the day, wrote actually little booklets, or at least that's how I read them when I was, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years old. I started reading Freud. And my best friend's dad was a psychologist, and we were just like into it. It was just curious stuff. But in any case, Freud talked about the superego, the ego, and the id, right? The superego is like, you know, critical parent. It's the part of you that says, oh, you shouldn't do that. Be careful. The ego is, well, we all know what ego is. That's, ta-da, that's me. And the id is this boiling, seething mass of emotion that's underneath everything, right? That colors and flavors everything. So here's what Giuliani said last night. I do not believe, and I know this is a horrible thing to say, but I do not believe that the president loves America. He doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me. He wasn't brought up the way you were brought up, and I was brought up through love of this country. Now, what's he saying with that? That the president wasn't brought up to love his country. That he was brought up as a black kid with white parents? Is that it? That he was brought up, that he lived in another country for a couple of, you know, it's like, this is just pure hatred.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And these guys are willing to start World War III. They're willing to help these terrorists just because they hate the president. That's how bizarre the Republican Party has got.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you.
George in Otto, North Carolina. Hey, George, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Always enjoy watching you.
Thank you.
Hey, been watching the news just like everybody else. Had a thought for you. Maybe you can expound on it. Give me your take on it. Mm-hmm. They're all going on about, you know, the ECB, the central bank in Europe, and what's going on between them and Greece. And then you add in the Ukraine conflict, and it seems to be Europe and America against Russia. It seems to me that if Russia really wanted to deal a death blow to the European Union, they could pretty much unwind it. All they got to do is just step in Greece and say, hey, man, we'll give you $5, $10 billion here. Be happy.
Just like Greece, we did with Ukraine.
Yeah. Greece would default on their debts to several different European countries.
Yeah. You know, the problem is it would take more than $5 or $10 billion. I think that Greece is in debt to the tune of several hundred billion. I could be wrong.
I think it's like 300 or 170 billion, I believe, last count. But the point is, once that happened and Greece defaulted, well, then next is Italy.
Yeah.
And what are they going to do? Podemos in Spain, and then you've got Ireland and the unrest there, and then Portugal, and boy, there goes the European Union.
And what that would do is it would provoke Germany to come down like a ton of bricks on Russia, and we would be back to fighting World War II all over again.
You think so?
I think so, yeah. I really think that we are very close to World War III right now. And that was sort of where I was going with that setup rant.
I hear you.
This is very dangerous stuff. And the people who remember the horrors of World War II, by and large, are dead or at least no longer making policy.
Hey, but there's people making money. I mean, as long as they're selling guns,
people
making money.
Oh, yeah. War is always insanely profitable.
George, I appreciate your opinion.
Yeah, George, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. That's a very thought-provoking comment. Prakash in Coalinga, California. Hey, Prakash, what's up?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Tom. I'm about your age, not as smart as you, and I've been watching your show for a very long time. Watch DirecTV 348, I guess, and I've been to very much of the same places that you've been. I'm from India. Totally believe in nonviolence. And I did not like what the French did, making fun of, not the French actually, but some of them, making fun of the Prophet Muhammad. I'm not a Muslim by any means. I'm a Hindu. But I don't believe you have the right to make fun of anyone, doesn't matter who it is. And I'm very glad that President Obama didn't go visit France like some of the other world leaders did. Yeah. Because I don't believe anyone has the right to call anyone names, especially a prophet or otherwise.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I think people have the right to do it. On the other hand, common sense should dictate, just like you have the right to walk up to somebody on the street and tell them that you think that they're dressed silly. It moves over into the area of assault if you threaten them. Interesting point. Interesting comment. Prakash, let me ponder that one. Thank you very much for the call. 20 minutes past there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. The White House, so this is the stuff that came out of this White House meeting yesterday. They're gonna try to build basically a web presence that will push back against these, what they refer to as, where'd the phrase go? Violent extremist messaging. This is the phrase. And, this is a great thing. I mean, there was a big vigil last night, by the way, in Arizona to honor Kyla Mueller, the American aid worker who died at the hands of ISIS. Meanwhile, I mean, just look at some of the stuff that's going on. I'm going to get into the Scott Walker stuff a little later and the Bush stuff, but it's really amazing. And the polar vortex, I want to get into that a little later. But do you see this headline in today's New York Times? Alan Cowell, just the headline. Britain says it sent warplanes to intercept Russian bombers off Cornwall.
What the hell is going on? The British Air Force scrambled warplanes to intercept two Russian bombers off the coast of Cornwall in southwest England, the defense ministry said on Thursday, as a government minister sounded alarms about the Kremlin's intentions elsewhere in Europe. When the Soviet Union fell, George Herbert Walker Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev worked out a deal for basically the West helping unravel the Soviet Union, but also providing some security assurances. And one of those security assurances that was explicitly made was that the West, the United States, NATO, and the European Union, would not lay claim to or try to set up any kind of military bases in Ukraine, because Ukraine is right on the Russian border. It is the middle ground. In fact, I believe the word Ukraine means the place in the middle. It's like in between Europe and Russia. And we are rubbing that sore so hard. And then you get that on top of here's Don Rumsfeld. The Islamic State's rise is like the period before World War II. He's actually, you know, in a certain way, this same thought's been going through my mind for some time now, is that sometimes you push all the way to the most outrageous in order to make a point. And then if you back up even a little bit, you seem quite reasonable. I see this all the time when I'm debating right wingers, and they'll just come out and say, well, we should just, you know, shut down every post office in the United States. Right? It's like Neil McCabe said yesterday on the program. Just privatize them all. Get the government out of the business. We should just turn Social Security over to Wall Street. I mean, this is what they really believe. And sometimes they come right out and say it. Now, Hitler pushed it all the way to the far wall. You know, kill the gypsies, kill the communists, kill the Jews, kill the gays, etc. And ISIS is now doing this, using violence and murder as their extremist tactic to get our attention. And in my book, The Crash of 2016, just out in paperback, I talk at some length about how when we die off, let me rephrase that. When the generation, as Arnold Toynbee is said to have said, when the generation that remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. Because only the glory is remembered. I was there for the Battle of the Bulge. No, I was there for the storming of Normandy. I was there when we liberated Dachau. Actually, you'd have to be a Russian to say that, but Auschwitz. But this is serious stuff. And I'm very concerned that we are playing with fire here. We are playing with World War III. There's a fellow who lives in Tunisia, and I've shared several of his emails with you in the past. I'm not going to name him for his own protection. But he just sent me a note that is rather startling. Just imagine that this was you. Can you imagine living in Tunisia? Or just living where you live and discovering that an enemy, you know, I mean, really seriously, they want to kill you, enemy, is just a few miles down the road and they're coming your way. He writes, Dear Tom, I have a concern I would like to share with you. As you know, I am in Tunisia, and I am also nominally a Muslim. I tell you this because I'd like you and all good people to know that between the Republican Party and ISIS moderate Muslims, those of us who just want to live our lives are facing a potential Holocaust. First, ISIS wants us either to subscribe to their false homicidal interpretation of Islam, and now the Republican Party is stoking the fires of hatred in the United States. You know that you say you don't like to use fascists to describe Republicans, but if you look closely at the Holocaust, you will see that the Nazis began by persecuting the Jewish community with words and small acts of violence. I hope people of goodwill will unite and bring an end to all this division and allow us to tackle the real enemies, poverty, hunger, and disease. As I write this, ISIS is poised to enter Tunisia. Please know how much I appreciate listening to your show. I hope that you and folks like you ultimately become the voices of sanity that pulls us back from the brink. Sincerely yours. Can you imagine? And we have the Republican Party, Fox so-called news, right-wing hate radio, and all these right-wing blogs trying to do the PR work for ISIS, asserting that they actually do represent Islam. These guys are willing to have people die to promote their political agenda of hating Obama.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The Obama administration is doing nothing less or more than the Bush administration did in not recognizing Islam as the source of the problem. But don't tell that to Republicans. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. I want to just circle back around to a couple of other things, and I'll pick up your phone calls here on these topics and others. I am going to get into Scott Walker at some length today. I've been telling you this for months. In fact, actually, I've been saying this for years. Scott Walker is the Koch brothers' bat boy, right? He is their boy. Remember that 20-minute long conversation where the liberal blogger was punking Scott Walker, called him, you know, got him on the phone, and he thought he was talking to the Koch brothers, and Scott, oh yes, please, thank you, sir. And one of the Koch brothers says, you've got a baseball bat? Here's how to deal with Democrats or with the unions. Got a baseball bat? Walker goes, yeah, I got one sitting right here in my office. Oh, good, good, good. Scott Walker, with the benefit of $890 million behind him coming out of the Koch machine, is going to be, if not the Republican presidential nominee, at least the vice presidential nominee, probably behind George Bush. Or Jeb Bush, excuse me. We will see. But I want to get into Scott Walker and all this stuff. But maybe we'll do this in the second hour in some detail. But the other piece, I mean, it's like, I keep waiting for shoes to drop, right? It's like, you know, the metaphorically speaking. You look out at the world situation and you think, okay, if we're on the edge of another worldwide Great Depression, and if we're on the edge of another world war, and both are possible. I mean, it's also possible that we're on the edge of 1,000 years of peace and economic prosperity and security. It would require us to take our country back from the billionaires and corporations that have completely or largely taken control of our political process, which is why I don't believe it. But, you know, you could make a case. But anyhow, you look around and say, you know, what started World War One? What started World War One was all these countries that were having low to moderate levels of tension with each other, having agreements, mutual defense agreements. So, you know, if somebody attacks you, it's as if they attack me, and we will join you in fighting back. And so, as you know, when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, it was seen as the Serbs against the Austro-Hungarians. And then, you know, from there it went to, oh, it must be the Serbs against the Russians, and okay, now, or the Germans rather, now that the Germans are involved, well, the Serbs are on the side of the Russians, so it must be the Russians against the, and pretty soon you got World War One going on. World War Two, you had a couple of death cults. The Japanese death cult being run by Emperor Hirohito and Tojo, the notorious Japanese general. And in Germany, you had a death cult being run by Adolf Hitler. And then there were some hangers-on to those death cults. You had Mussolini and you had Franco. And as countries fell, you know, you had the Vichy government in France and you had the Nazi government in Norway. And I mean, they're still dealing with some of these people. So, this is what brought us to World War twice in the last century. Are there similar conditions now? Are there countries that are facing each other with substantial tension who have mutual defense alliances with other countries that don't necessarily view those countries as allies? And for that matter, within the countries that are allies, are we seeing alliances start to disintegrate? Well, here's some shoes dropping for you. The Russian-speaking or pro-Russian or whatever you want to call it, pro-independence, I would even say, people in the east of Ukraine who don't want to become part of Russia. They just want to have autonomy. They want to they want to stay part of Ukraine, but they want to be able to elect a local governor, basically. This is what they have been saying all along. We just want federalism. We want it like you have in the United States. We want to be a state. Because right now in Kiev, the federal government appoints not just the governor of the state, but also the mayors of the cities. They have no representation. So you've got that going on, and they just, you know, these rebels just took another major city. And the Ukrainians are pulling back. And so, you know, okay, what are we going to do? The United States and Western Europe, by and large, started this thing by supporting a coup that overthrew a democratically elected president. I mean, go back to Victoria Nuland's tapes. Well, I don't want to relitigate the Ukraine. Point is that that's a serious possible ignition point for a world war. We are taking on Russia via proxy in Ukraine. Similarly, we're taking on China by proxy via Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, particularly given some of the disputes over territory in both cases. But in third, perhaps most importantly, we're taking on pretty much everybody in the Middle East. And you've got, you know, these right wingers trying to make the situation even worse. Then within Europe, you've got the European Union starting to disintegrate. Greece, you know, tomorrow, Greece has to pay, I think, $5 billion on the $300 billion in loans that they've got from various EU banksters and countries. And they're saying, you know, can we just extend that 6 months? And the Germans just said, no, not going to do it. Naughty child. This could easily be a flashpoint. So any of these things in my mind could arguably trigger World War III. And then there's some things, you know, that could make it even, I mean, far, far worse. You know, we're messing in Russia's backyard. We're giving billions of dollars to a government that Russia doesn't view as legitimate in Ukraine to prop them up and to militarily supply them. What if Russia did that? We had a caller in the last about 20 minutes ago, 25 minutes ago, who asked this question. What if Russia said to Greece, you know, we'll pick up those debts that you have to the EU. You owe the EU $300 billion. Cool. Here's $300 billion. Pay them off and join us. Become part of the new Eastern Bloc of trading rather than the Western Bloc, rather than the European Union. How do you think Europe would respond? I mean, it's just, I don't think they're going to do that. I think that would be really, really, really inadvisable. But God only knows. So, anyhow, we'll pick up some of your phone calls here, and then I want to get into my polar vortex rant, my Scott Walker rant, and the did you see this piece in The Guardian about this? It's titled Bad Lieutenant. There was this Chicago police lieutenant who was famous for getting convictions based on confessions. And he's the guy that we sent over to Guantanamo Bay to teach them how to interrogate people. Turns out that what he did in Gitmo in Abu Ghraib, first he went to Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and then he went to or to Afghanistan, wherever it is, and then he went to Guantanamo. What this guy was doing in Chicago was shackling people to the floor for 24 hours, and well, in fact, his name is Zuley, Richard Zuley, Z-U-L-E-Y. They sent him to Guantanamo in late 2002. 25 years on the streets of Chicago. A Guardian investigation has uncovered that Zuley used similar tactics for years. We're talking prolonged shackling, family threats, demands on suspects to implicate themselves and others. That Zuley used similar tactics for years behind closed-door police stations on Chicago's poor and non-white citizens. Multiple people in prison in Illinois insist they have been wrongly convicted on the basis of coerced confessions extracted by Zuley and his colleagues. The Guardian examined thousands of court documents from Chicago and interviewed 24 people with experience at Gitmo and the Chicago criminal justice system. Zuley and his colleagues shackled suspects to the wall. This is in Chicago. For extended periods, threatened their family members and perhaps even planted evidence on them. The point was to yield confessions while even ignoring potentially exculpatory evidence. A woman in an Illinois prison who insists on her innocence, Benita Johnson, recalled Zuley and his team handcuffing her to a wall for over 24 hours in 1995 until she would implicate herself and her ex-boyfriend in a murder, while Zuley threatened her with never seeing her children again. Nearly a decade later, his interrogation plan for Mohammed Ould Shalhai at Guantanamo received personal sign-off from then-Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld, but it has gone almost entirely unreported that he told the detainee that that the United States had his mother in custody, that he was going to bring her to Gitmo's all-male prison. Basically, this is a rape threat. At that point, this guy started confessing to anything and everything. Confessing to places he'd never been, things he'd never done, people he'd never seen. Just don't rape my mother. Brilliant.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, this is clearly Bush-era stuff, but this is how you set up the next world war. This is how you destroy American credibility. This is the kind of damage that Fox and the right are doing to America. Welcome back. Larry in Santa Monica. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Actually, I already answered a question in regards to giving me a rationale for you. We're headed for World War III. Do you think there's a possibility that it may be nuclear? Putin already threatened that he would.
Of course.
Use.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. First of all, let me just be very clear. I am not suggesting that we are on the edge of World War III, and I don't certainly want us to have World War III. What I'm suggesting is that the conditions are such that, you know, it's like we're standing in a dry forest with a book of matches in our hands. If we light the match and drop it into the kindling, then the forest might catch on fire. But if we choose to walk away, or if we choose to do something to get some water into the forest, then, you know. But anyhow, what specifically was your question?
Well, it's pretty depressing. Well, like I said, you already answered my question earlier. I was really wanted you to lay out a rationale as to why you thought we were headed towards World War III, and who would the players be? Who would the opponents be?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, the Middle East can rapidly become a proxy war. Let us not forget that Bashar al-Assad in Syria is a client of Russia. He's an ally of Russia. They have a mutual defense treaty. And we've been talking about taking this guy down. So it's possible that the Middle East could bring us into conflict. It's certainly possible Ukraine could bring us into conflict. Southeast Asia or Southern Asia in general is problematic. China is getting very, very aggressive and very bellicose. And if China encounters an economic crisis, which is, in my mind, all but certain, they have been growing too fast for too long, you know, in a growth period that has been fueled by predatory exporting and by, you know, massive construction of infrastructure that exceeds the demand for it, the need for it. So you've got literally empty cities now in China that have been built. When that slowdown in China hits China hard, it's going to hit the whole world, and it's, you know, it's going to be all bets are off. This is the lesson here, the net of all of this, Larry, is that, in my opinion, this is the time that Americans need to be doing everything possible to calm things down. And that's what President Obama has been doing, or to some extent. I disagree with his drone policy, but in general, what he's been trying to do is calm things down. No, we're not going to call them Muslims. We're not going to give them credibility. We're not going to declare a war on Islam. We're not, you know, come on, you got 20,000 crazy people. We can deal with this. The president is trying to do this in a fairly stable way, but you've got these hysterics on the right who see a 2016 presidential campaign coming along and a Senate campaign, and they intend to run as war hawks. And, you know, there's enough people in America who see the horrors of what ISIS does. And then you got Fox News actually running ISIS's propaganda videos in their entirety on their website and in abbreviated form on their television network, doing the work of ISIS. And that, you know, that really concerns me. Larry, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here. I am not saying World War III is imminent or even probable. It's possible. And if it happens, it will happen because neocons and hard right wingers have chosen political gain in the United States over what's best for our country. They have made the cold, calculated, cruel decision that they would rather damage the President of the United States' ability to conduct foreign policy for political gain than have a rational foreign policy that we're all behind. We used to say in the United States, politics ends at the shoreline. It ends at the border. It ends at the you know, where the Atlantic and Pacific are. In other words, we all stand behind our commander-in-chief. Not the case anymore. Here you've got, you know, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, negotiating with the Prime Minister of a foreign country to come over to the United States and address Congress without advising the President, who is in charge of our foreign policy. And then I don't know if you saw this, Netanyahu, he's taking some real serious criticism in Israel for, you know, kind of a Chris Christie lifestyle. He likes to live large. And so to push back, they brought a film crew into his home, and his wife gave them a tour of their kitchen, where the doors didn't close all the way, and there was, like, you know, crumbs on the floor, and it just kind of looked rather shabby. And everybody was like, whoa. Turns out it was the servants' quarters. Really? Anyway, John in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, John, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I hope you're staying warm in that.
Yeah, we're doing our best. Tonight's going to be the big test. What's up?
That's right. Get to the point. Living here in the Indianapolis area, we're a very strong blue-collar state, and I absolutely love it. I lived in Texas for 9 years, and I wish I had those 9 years back. Anyways, with this movie, The Sniper, has come out, a lot of right-wing people are becoming, using it as propaganda. Basically, especially here, a lot of people around me they wish they were veterans, not necessarily served in the military, they just wish they were veterans so they could feel like they could attach themselves to that movie. Right. And I tell them, I'm sorry, I just have no interest in seeing that, but oh my gosh, you need to go see that, because if you don't, you're un-American. I hate you and all that kind of stuff. And well, I don't know if other people are getting the same backlash, because they just don't want to see it either. They just don't want to, or becoming, they're just anti-war and they don't want to deal with that. Because if you watch and you deal with people's interactions, they're becoming more and more as a propaganda machine. Yeah. I don't know what your thoughts are on something like that.
No, my, you know, the predicate of the war in Iraq never enters into the movie, which was made by Clint Eastwood, who famously showed up with an empty chair at the Republican convention. And it never points out that this guy who's in somebody else's country, killing somebody else's people, it never points out that he is there illegally, that we invaded their country without cover of law, without any rationale or reason that made any sense. The rest of the world was telling Bush there were no weapons of mass destruction there. The UN had spent a year looking for them. They weren't there. Hussein was saying there's nothing there. So, you know, the movie is based on a lie. The war was based on a lie. And I have no doubt that there are many acts of nobility, bravery, and sacrifice that were made by our soldiers in Iraq. But they shouldn't have been there in the first place. They shouldn't have been in that position. They shouldn't have had to do it. And yeah, I have not gone to see American Sniper either, John. I have no interest. I don't go to war movies. I can't handle it. I flinch and cringe. And, you know, when somebody gets killed in that kind of cartoon way that they kill people on TV movies or TV shows, I wince. And I'm too empathetic, I guess. I never went to see The Deer Killer. I never, you know, I walked out in the middle of Cuckoo's Nest when it first came out. It was too violent for me. Couldn't handle it. So, yeah, I get it. John, thank you for the call. Irene in Meridian, Idaho. Hey, Irene.
Oh, this is a pleasure. I've been listening to you since you were on KPOJ.
Oh, thank you.
And I had an interesting, I guess I'm saying it wrong, but he had Christine Alexander on this morning. He's back on the
Carl.
Air.
You're talking about
and,
Carl?
So I'm in Idaho, and I love watching Oregon do so much better than
yeah,
we do.
Yeah, you're talking about Carl Wolfson. His show is, he's still doing his show, and it's on X-Ray FM, and it's on the internet.
It's
you can
wonderful.
Easily track it down.
And then you were on that program afterwards, but
right.
I went from Seattle to Denver, and then I'm now listening to you on Chicago, and I ended up buying a internet radio just to listen to you people.
Wowie zowie. Okay.
Anyway, I thought Christine Alexander was interesting. She was talking about ISIS, and she was going back to school, and she was talking about listening to a professor. And I thought the example of what he called ISIS was something that you might think is an interesting point. He was calling ISIS the Muslim Mafia.
That's exactly what they are.
I agree.
Yeah, and you never heard Bobby Kennedy, who took on the mafia in the United States, refer to them as Catholic terrorists.
No.
They were criminals.
Who's my partner says, no, that can't be. That's called, they're Italians. And I says, no, there was an Irish mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And there was other mafias. They're just gangs.
Yeah.
You know, they're just they're just, what do you call them, gang lords.
Yeah. Yeah, they're criminals is what
they
are. It's organized crime. And that's what's going on in the Middle East right now, is you've got organized crime being run by some sociopaths who are trying to establish credibility, desperately trying to establish credibility by begging the President of the United States to call them Muslims. And the President of the United States will not give them that satisfaction.
And we don't call ourselves Christian Ku Klux Klan, or the guy that killed Dr. Tiller,
right,
as being a terrorist or a Christian fanatic.
Yeah, that would be giving him what he wants. He's trying to assert that he did it because he's a Christian, but I don't think any Christian is going to say, yeah, I'm like him. Irene, very, very good call. Thank you very much for the call. Very, very interesting thoughts. We'll be back. I want to get into the Koch Brothers dog show. Yes, seriously. The polar vortex. And a little more on ISIL. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There are a lot of reasons to be actually very optimistic and hopeful right now. We have technology that is amazing. We're on the edge of a breakthrough. I mean, it's not even a breakthrough. We have the existing technology right now. We would need a political breakthrough to make it happen, but we have the ability to stop using fossil fuel all around the world, to transport the third world, the developing world, and the undeveloped world into the solar age without even going through the fossil fuel age, move them right from burning twigs to having solar panels. We have a level of economic sophistication that is the result of experience that allows us to use things like central banks to avoid horrible depressions or at least try to mitigate them. Now, that may come back to bite us. We'll see. You know, kind of, you could argue the downside of technology is our destructive technology has become even worse. Somebody in the last hour said, well, do you think if there's World War III, it would become nuclear? The lesson of all wars, World War I, poison gas, World War II ended with a nuclear bomb. The lesson of all world wars is that the worst weapons that exist do get used. But there's two sides to this. There's two pieces to this. My friend Earl Katz sent this to me from Howard Zinn. It was quoted on Common Dreams as part of their winter fund drive happening over at commondreams.org. And what Howard Zinn said is, to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there were many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now, as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. Now, that said, the United States has confronted terrible times before as well. And Dan Sisson and I wrote a book about this. It's called the American Revolution of 1800. This was the first crisis after we became a, you know, full-blown democratic republic. John Adams was taking us down this road of, for lack of a better word, oligarchy, of kleptocracy, of a very hardcore right-wing government. He had passed the Alien Sedition Acts in 1798. Thomas Jefferson, his vice president, was so offended by this, he left town so he wouldn't be in town when they were signed. The Alien Sedition Acts, which allowed John Adams to shut down almost 20 newspapers who all said things that had offended him. He threw their publishers in prison. Benjamin Franklin Bach, Ben Franklin's grandson, was thrown in jail. He lost the Aurora, his newspaper. And what had he said? He had said that John Adams was old, toothless, balding, and querulous. For that, he went to prison and he lost his newspaper. And Thomas Jefferson is looking at this going, and a lot of people are looking at this going, okay, the American experiment is over. John Adams has gone to the dark side. His wife is leading the charge, Abigail. She's the one who strongly argued that whenever they come into any city in America, the local militia had to come out, fire the cannons, and say, God save President Adams and his wife. So here we are, 2 weeks before the Alien Sedition Acts were passed. This is June 1st, 1798. Adams, the law had not passed yet, and John Adams, President Adams, was already arresting newspaper editors because he knew that the law was going to pass. And the Vice President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, sat down at his desk on June 1st, 1798, his heart heavy but hopeful, took his quill pen and dipped it in the ink pad and wrote a note to his old friend John Taylor. John Taylor was one of the anti-federalists, the Democratic Republicans, now known as the Democratic Party. In fact, 2 decades later, Taylor wrote a book that is Construction Construed and Constitutions Vindicated, that's a great history of constitutions. And here's what Jefferson wrote. He said, it is true that we are completely under the saddle of Massachusetts and Connecticut. Massachusetts, keep in mind, wanted to be a theocracy. Connecticut was the home of rich people. When Matthew Lyon, who was the U.S. Congressman from Vermont in 1798, during this era, during this little window of time, Matthew Lyon stood up in the House of Representatives and called out Roger Griswold by name and said, Roger Griswold was the representative from Connecticut, and said, Mr. Griswold, you are representing the interests of the rich and powerful exclusively in this chamber. And Griswold got so angry by that charge, which today somebody like Scott Walker would say, well, of course I am. I mean, don't say it in public, though. That's the sin. The Griswold picked up a poker from the fireplace. Back then, you know, the Capitol building was heated with fireplaces. Picked up a poker and came after Matthew Lyon. Beat him up. And then had the police arrest him. And John Adams sent Matthew Lyon off to prison in Vermont, in Vergennes, Vermont. He spent the next 2 years in a unheated jail cell in Vermont, where he ran for re-election in the election of 1800, the American Revolution of 1800, and won. And John Adams lost. So anyhow, this is the time. And Jefferson says, you know, he sits down to write this letter to his friend John Taylor. It is true that we're completely under the saddle of Massachusetts and Connecticut, that they ride us very hard, cruelly insulting our feelings as well as exhausting our strength and subsistence. Their natural friends, the three other eastern states, join them as sort of a family pride, and they have the art to divide certain other parts of the Union so as to make use of them to govern the whole. Is he not describing the red state, blue state strategy that the Koch brothers, the billionaires, are funding to divide America? He said, this is not new. This is from Thomas Jefferson's letter to John Taylor, June 1st, 1798. This is not new. It is the old practice of despots to use a part of the people to keep the rest in order. And once those who have got an ascendancy and possess themselves of all the resources of the nation, their revenues and offices, have immense means for retaining their advantage. But, he said, our present situation is not a natural one. I still repeat it. This is not the natural state. Be this as it may, in every free and deliberating society, there must, from the nature of man, be opposite parties and violent discussions and discords. And one of these, for the most part, must prevail over the other for a longer or shorter time. Perhaps this party division is necessary to induce each to watch and delate to the people the proceedings of the other. But will the evil stop there? And then Jefferson ends his letter. He said, a little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolved, and the people recovering their true sight, restoring their government to its true principles. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit and incurring the horrors of war and long oppressions of enormous public debt. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience until luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost. For this is a game where principles are the stake.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is the perfect stepping off point for my riff on Scott Walker and the Koch brothers, which I will get into in a few minutes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, on Dish Network. Hey, Kenyatta, what's up?
How are you, Tom? I am fine. If I can, just take a second. I want to thank you for being, honestly, the classiest and most considerate radio talk show host there is. And I say that because yesterday I like to know what the other people are thinking, and occasionally I listen to conservative radio, and I'm sure you've heard of Michael Medvedev, and I was
I know Michael.
A caller on his show. Pardon?
I know Michael.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And he's apparently not on his show, and he had a guest host. Anyway, I won't get into all of that, but and the guy was very respectful with me. Frankly, I lit him up, but he wasn't so much with other people. And I watch O'Reilly and all these, and it, you know, even when you disagree with people, Tom, and I've heard, listened to your show and heard some just foaming at the mouth people with views that are way out, way whacked out. You've never insulted anybody. You always show respect, and I, you know, just here in Hartman Nation, I just wanted to say that to you, and it's heartfelt.
Well, thank you, Kenya. Thank you very much. Is that what you wanted to talk about?
I do want to say this to you about ISIS. You know, there's always a word that's when these recruits are being described, these ISIS recruits, the word disillusioned young men is always used, disillusioned.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that may be a tactical error using that term, and I'll tell you why. We may unwittingly, by using that term, be validating ISIS ideology. Now, what I mean by that is if I go to a Davy Copperfield show, Tom, I watch him perform illusions.
Right.
So if I'm disillusioned, then that means that I'm seeing the reality of it. I'm seeing clarity. Now, look, I'm simply saying that that might not be a wise thing to do, because right here in the United States, within our own ranks, we have a whole demographic of disillusioned people.
Right.
So, you know, that's just food for thought. Lastly, I wanted to say this. You are so on target. Now, honestly, you know, I'm at this point scared to death about what could potentially happen in the world right now. I think we're closer to World War III than we ever have. I think we're closer to a nuclear exchange than we've ever been. You spoke about Ukraine. You spoke about South Korea and Japan and China, that problem. And then there's ISIS, but we've got the ever-present issue of Israeli-Palestinian issue, and I can assure you that that is going to escalate in the next few months. And there's another factor, Tom, that you didn't really mention, and that's the race factor here. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that you'll notice now the Republicans, or the right wing, as they're called, and it's funny how the right wing philosophy is very close to ISIS ideology, but I won't go there. They're talking about Barack Obama being a Muslim. You know, there's always been that hump.
Right.
He's a Muslim. He's a Muslim sympathizer. Well, even though that Muslims come in all varieties, just like Christians, and there are plenty of European Muslims of European descent, most Muslims, I would venture, come from places where people are dark or brown or something.
Yeah.
Barack Obama is dark or brown. So my concern is that, you know, this could really get out of control. It just hasn't coalesced yet.
Well, I think it has in the Tea Party side. I mean, you've got a large cohort of uninformed white America who believes what, you know, what you're saying, that Obama's a secret Muslim, and probably out of racist reasons. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, Scott Walker, this is really fascinating. Julie Bykovitz, excuse me, wrote a piece for Newsmax. Newsmax is one of the most far right of the far right publications. And in the last couple of years, they've got a big infusion of cash from somebody. And now they're doing Newsmax TV. And in fact, for a couple of months there, whenever I got on a United Airlines flight, it was Newsmax TV on every TV in the entire plane. You know, they were clearly paying for exposure kind of thing of rolling out their new network. And Julia's writing about the Scott Walker phenomenon. Now, Scott Walker and the Kochs. And she writes, you know, the relationship between the Kochs and Walker was cemented during Walker's bitter war. Now, keep in mind, this is a right-wing publication. This is, they're speaking, she's speaking admiringly of them. The relationship between the Kochs and Walkers was cemented during the Walker, during Walker's bitter war against public unions that led to a recall election in 2012. During the tense weeks of standoff at the Capitol in Madison, it was the Kochs' Tea Party troops who provided the main counterforce to the tens of thousands of union activists protesting the governor in a battle that Walker eventually won. As the struggle raged, Walker's alliance with his benefactors was embarrassingly satirized when a liberal blogger posted, posing as David Koch, who at that point Walker had never met, kept him on the line for 20 minutes, making the governor look like a lapdog to the powerful industrialists. Then she writes, this year the relationship may evolve in unpredictable ways. Now, I'll predict how it's going to evolve. He's going to be the presidential nominee or the vice presidential nominee, and the Kochs are going to throw everything they've got behind him. With three tough statewide elections, Julie writes, victories under his belt. Walker, 47, is poised to pursue the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. The Kochs have pledged to marshal some $900 million to spend in the fight for the presidency. And, you know, and she talks about who and how. The Kochs and Walker now share a donor pool, a moneyed set that isn't the establishment Jeb Bush is counting on. One Koch stalwart solidly in Walker's corner is Stanley Hubbard, a billionaire Minnesota broadcast executive. Hubbard supplied a quick assessment of the center-right 2016 field. Jeb Bush may be a great guy, but his last name is Bush. Chris Christie blew himself up with, among other things, his preference for luxury travel. And then this billionaire said, quote, I am actively encouraging Scott to run, and I know of many other people who are very positive about Walker running. Charles and David Koch, she notes, founded Americans for Prosperity in 2003. The Kochs, I'm quoting from her article at Newsmax, Julie's article, the Kochs positioned Americans for Prosperity as the Tea Party's staunchest ally. And then she talks about how Koch Industries itself is starting to turn on the cash. Meanwhile, Koch's Industries began to turn on the cash spigots. In July 2010, the first of two contributions from Koch Industries' Political Action Committee arrived in Walker's campaign coffers. The company, which has also been a top donor to the Republican Governors Association, and that group spent $5 million attacking Walker's Democratic opponent, Tom Barrett, in a torrent of 2.9 million mailers and a series of eight different television ads. David Koch told the Palm Beach Post in February 2012, quote, we're helping him, Scott Walker, as we should. What Scott Walker is doing with public unions in Wisconsin is critically important. He's an impressive guy. He's very courageous. It goes on and on. You know, the footage of Walker and Hendricks, billionaire Diane Hendricks, the million-dollar donor to the Koch network. She says she's smitten with Walker. She's given him over $530,000 over the years. She asked him when Wisconsin could become completely red so he could work on the unions, her phrase, work on. He said his plan was to, quote, divide and conquer the unions by starting with the public sector. He did that a couple of weeks later after that conversation with her. And Walker has already shattered records in his home state, raising about $83 million in three elections. Net, Scott Walker is... he's the guy. Jeff Danziger, you can see it in the New York Times. It's also over at democraticunderground.com. He's a cartoonist, right? And the cartoon shows the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, walking a dog. And they're saying, good dog, good dog. And the dog has the Scott Walker's head on it. And in fact, the caption is Koch brothers' entry at the dog show, Scott Walker. And then here's a piece in today's Washington Post, right up at the top. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is scheduled to attend a private dinner Wednesday with longtime advocates of supply-side economics. They're meeting at Club 21 in Manhattan. So it's going to cost a fortune. Economists Larry Kudlow, Art Laffler, and Stephen Moore, all former guests on this program, by the way, will host Walker, according to several people with knowledge of the event. For decades, that trio of friends, all associated with President Ronald Reagan's economic policies, had been high-profile proponents of using tax cuts to boost economic growth. Laffer is best known for the Laffer Curve. Moore, former Wall Street Journal editorial writer and founder of the Club for Growth, now works at the Heritage Foundation. Kudlow, fixture on cable television, was one of Reagan's advisors on fiscal and economic matters. And then they talk about this billionaire supermarket owner and former Republican mayoral candidate in New York, John Castamatitis. I'm not sure how to say it. He's sponsoring the occasion. And among those planning to appear, investment banker Louis Lerman, anti-tax activist Grover Norquist, philanthropist Jimmy Kemp, the son of Jack Kemp, late New York congressman, who ushered Reagan's tax reforms through Congress. I'm telling you, it's coming. And Scott Walker is Ronald Reagan. He's got, you know, the "aw shucks, I'm just like you. I'm not all polished and fancy and I, you know." I mean, Reagan rode horses. Walker, you know, I don't know what he does. Well, he rides around a pickup truck. A little bit of Scott Browning, right? This is something to take very seriously. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's something to take particularly seriously during this era of polar vortexes, brought to you by global warming. There's just so much in the news today. It's amazing. Britain sending warships. Rudy Giuliani. I mean, it just consider this for a moment. This is from, you know, one of America's foremost idiots, for lack of a better word. I'm running out of adjectives. I would say racist, but I don't think that is actually a strong enough word to describe what I think of Rudy Giuliani. And I've thought this of Rudy Giuliani ever since he was the head cop in New York City. He was the attorney general, I guess it was, or whatever the title was, state's attorney, something or other. Anyhow, when he wanted to run for mayor, he started arresting people who ran head shops for selling cigarette papers. I mean, that's how Rudy Giuliani got famous. And he's always had this history of beating up on people who really, you know, they just kind of got in the way. But they got in the way of Rudy Giuliani's political career. And here's what he said. He said, "I do not believe," and I know this is a horrible thing to say. Yes, it is a horrible thing to say, Rudy. You should just stop right there. But he didn't. He said, "I do not believe," and I know this is a horrible thing to say, "but I do not believe that the president loves America. He doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me. He wasn't brought up the way you were brought up, and I was brought up, through love of this country." It's amazing. And yet these guys will mark my words, fall into line behind Scott Walker or behind Jeb Bush, the guy who signed the 1998 Project for a New American Century ultimatum to Bill Clinton that you better attack Iraq. I'm assuming you've seen the Venn diagram of Jeb Bush's advisors and his daddy and his brother's advisors. They're all the same people with one exception. But anyhow, I said, you know, this Scott Walker becomes particularly dangerous in a time of global warming. And I mean that very sincerely. The Koch brothers inherited a very, very big business from their daddy. Daddy Fred made millions with Joe Stalin helping the Soviet Union develop their oil resources. He didn't like Joe Stalin. He didn't like communism. He came back to the United States after he made his fortune and helped fund the John Birch Society and raised his boys right. As rich, self-involved, narcissistic whatevers. And these guys know that their fortune, a large chunk of their fortune, depends on fossil fuels and on continuing to burn fossil fuels. And so they're funding people who are running around saying, "Oh, it's like tobacco. You know, there's no proof it causes cancer. There's no proof that fossil fuels cause global warming. We won't really know until after everybody's dead. When we're all extinct, then we'll know." Well, we're starting to know right now. This, in today's Washington Post, Angela Fritz from the Capital Weather Gang. The coldest air of the season is surging south this week, leading to what could be historic cold for parts of the eastern United States. Thursday and Friday's polar outbreak could set all-time February low records from Tennessee to Virginia. All this is courtesy of a plume of not just Arctic, but Siberian air that has been trudging across the North Pole and into North America over the past week. Now, that said, where did it go? I had the Siberian. Here it is. The weather forecast right now for Zalinda, Siberia, Russia. Right? Zalinda. This is from the Weather Underground. It is 45 degrees below zero today. However, today is forecast to be much warmer than yesterday. It's 45 degrees below zero right now. It's the middle of the night right now. They're predicting that tomorrow when the sun comes out, it's going to get up to 23 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. It's astonishing. So that air did not used to come into North America, or at least it didn't used to come this far south. And the thing that used to prevent it from coming this far south was something called the jet stream. The jet stream is a river of air that circles the northern hemisphere just south of the North Pole, just south of the Arctic region, and just north of us. Basically, you know, goes across Siberia and Canada. And it's a fairly stiff wall. I mean, it's moving 100 miles an hour and more. And there's a lot of pressure differential associated with it because there's a lot of temperature differential associated with it. It's very cold in the Arctic. It's relative to a minus 45 degree temperature. Here, it's very warm, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 degrees. Normally, this time of year, it'd be in the 30s or 40s. So why is it going to be 2 degrees or maybe even 2 degrees below zero tonight? Well, because that temperature difference between our latitudes and the Arctic latitudes has decreased because the Arctic is warming faster than we are, somewhere between 2 and 6 times faster than we are. And this has to do with a whole bunch of different variables. Part of it has to do with the loss of reflectivity of the snow ice or of the ice, the Arctic ice. Part of it has to do with the tilt toward and away from the sun. Part of it has to do with, you know, how much landmass there is, the rotation of the Earth, all these other things. But basically, that jet stream used to keep us from getting these polar winds, you know, except under very, very extraordinary circumstances. Now, this is the second winter in a row that we're getting this. This is the new normal, or it may well be the new normal. And if that's the case, we really have, I mean, I'm telling you. In our marina, I did it very gently, very carefully. 1 foot on the dock, my hands on the boat, so I've got something to hang on to, and 1 foot on the ice between the dock and the boat. And then I just slowly moved all my weight onto that 1 foot on the ice. The ice didn't even creak. I got 3 inches of ice all around the boat right now. It's like everything. The river's frozen all the way across. This, you know, I mean, it happens from time to time. But this is nuts. And the Koch brothers want to put up a guy, Scott Walker, who will openly proclaim global warming is not a concern of his because his patrons are oil billionaires. This is not how democracy should work. This is not how a country should work. We shouldn't be saying, oh, who's going to be the candidate? Oh, it's going to depend on who's got the most money. The Democratic side, Hillary Clinton's got the most money. On the Republican side, Scott Walker probably is going to have the most money because he's got the Koch brothers behind him. And we sit around and complain about other countries where, you know, like in China, for example, in Hong Kong. The protesters in Hong Kong, you know what they're protesting over? They don't want the Communist Party to be picking who the candidates are for mayor of Hong Kong or governor of Hong Kong. They want to be able to pick that person themselves independent of a political party. You can't do that in the United States. It's amazing. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you? This goes ways back to your opening in your show. The thing about and Giuliani in particular, but the entire Republican Party, at least the leadership, I really think it's a lot of the voters too. I hate to say this, they've regressed into basically a group of people that essentially they live in a world of complete psychological projection, and they're projecting their own pathology upon the world. Giuliani was doing this with Obama. I think he hates America. He hates what we at least originally were, but this is so prevalent in the Republican Party, they just spoo this psychological projection. But I'm so glad you talk about this stuff, because we don't hear this stuff nearly enough. There's such a void of knowledge of psychology in America today. There's always been, but it's really bad now. And this is what drives these people in a large, large
part. Well, and nobody's seriously talking back to the right wing outside of maybe Rachel Maddow. And she can't talk back to the right wing if it has to do with international trade or if it has to do with net neutrality. I mean, you know, and there may be other topics that she's that basically MSNBC hosts are not allowed to talk about. You know, unions is probably high on that list. I think NBC is having a fight with the union, you know, as we speak. But there's nobody. I mean, you know, yeah. Thanks for the tip of the hat, Will. But you know, this is more Americans need to be having this conversation. Will, thank you for the call. John in Minneapolis, got a minute to the break. John, it's all yours. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, on an optimistic note, Gandhi said that in the end, you know, evil men will rule and prosper for a while, but in the end they always fall. I don't know if that's the exact quote, but, you know, you get the gist of the meaning. And so I always try to remember that. And I'd like to say about Mayor Giuliani, he forgets his own past and how Italians, it was synonymous with being a terrorist. Remember Sacco and Vanzetti? And you know, how they were blocked out of so many opportunities, no matter how many qualifications they might have, simply because they were Italian. And so when he uses the, you know, describes Islamic terrorists as if all people who, you know, practice the Muslim faith are terrorists, I mean, he forgets his own history. But what I really wanted to talk about was Scott Walker and how him, with the help of the Koch brothers, have driven a wedge and taken advantage of a very conservative outstate Wisconsin, which is really similar to a very conservative Minnesota outstate, and then, you know, the urban, you know, centers. I mean, you know, when you live in Washington, D.C., or if you live in New York, you know, you have these vast...
John, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour. And welcome back. Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind today?
Well, actually, I was curious to know if you have seen the similarities between the conservatives in this country of today and the fascists in Europe back during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and what does that mean in our country if we're seeing a pattern of this going on?
Well, fascism is, you know, kind of the ultimate conservative statement. Fascism is the merger of corporation and state combined with belligerent national foreign policy. And that certainly describes Mussolini's Italy and Franco's Spain and to some extent Hitler's Germany, at least Hitler's early Germany. I would argue that Hitler was not a fascist, that he was the leader of a death cult, the Nazis, and that the Nazis went way beyond fascism. But yeah, I did a couple of days on this a week or two ago. Back on April 9th, 1944, the Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace, was asked to write a piece for the New York Times about fascists in America. And he said, in fact, maybe I can just even grab it very quickly here. He said that the American fascists that we have to worry about are not the guys who are running around with swastikas on their armbands. He said the American fascists that we have to worry about are basically the people running the corporations in the boardrooms. And he said they claim to be super patriots, but actually they're always calling for monopoly. Well, here's the exact phrase. He said they claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interests. Their final objective, toward which all of their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that, using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common working man in eternal subjection.
Right, right.
That was 1944. That was the Vice President of the United States calling out so-called conservatives at that time.
Well, you see, the thing is in the 30s, Sinclair Lewis mentioned something that if fascism ever comes to this country, it'll be in the form of a flag and hiding behind a Bible.
Yeah, it'll be wrapped in a flag and they'll be carrying a cross. Or was, yeah, you're right. And it can't happen here was the title of his book.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you, Cliff, and it concerns me tremendously, just tremendously. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Good day, sir. God, you have touched on so many points today, Tom. And this is such a I think the point that I want to make is if we put it in a line of ideology and action on the far right, I saw and you brought this up, Newsmax, earlier in the show. I saw a documentary on Newsmax here about a month ago, and I've been meaning to call you on it, but haven't. The name of the documentary is I Killed JFK, in which you had written a book on it. And I watched this thing more than once, Tom, and it basically is the testimony of a man by the name of James Sutton Files,
right,
who appeared to be in prison at the time, who was a underworld hitman, who had a relationship with the CIA, who had members that went on to be involved in Iran-Contra, flying people around.
Randy, I got to tell you, I haven't seen the documentary. I'm sure Lamar has, and he could comment on it, my writing partner on the JFK stuff. But I haven't, so I can't really comment on it. But thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing it up. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney is with us, the author of Sideswiped and reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. And how are you?
I'm great. It's nice to see you.
You brought me into the modern world, kicking and screaming, but here I am on
tonight.
So it's nice to be with you.
Okay, so what's going on in the world today?
Well, you know, there was the conference on extremism, and I think it's worth noting that there seems to be the undertow and now the actual out-on-the-counter talk like Rudy Giuliani, where he has made some outrageous statements about the president not loving the country and that he wasn't raised the same way as Giuliani and, quote, other Americans.
Right.
And part of that is coming, obviously, on people just, you know, they might as well try to lay it on the table that the president, you know, was raised in a Muslim family, et cetera, you know, because some religious leaders have said that, not all the religious community. And I mention that because, you know, they're trying to really make this about President Obama. And I think the president pretty well clarified yesterday at the meeting with the extremism issue at the White House, that he understands the give and take of this entire thing, but also the fact that you just can't condemn an entire group of people or a religion, you know, over it. So I thought that the extremism conference at the White House was something of value,
mm-hmm,
in it. And I would also note, when Rudy Giuliani on the other side of this likes to talk about the love of the country and how he was raised, Rudy Giuliani had been paid, by the way, and this isn't advertised a lot, by the Mujahideen Khalq, by a group that, in fact, they were the group that took our American personnel from the American embassy hostage, and they were on the terrorist list for quite a long time, and he was actually paid for them. So I guess it's his version of who loves America or not.
You're talking about MAC?
That's right.
Yeah, they were considered terrorists up until Congress changed the designation as a result of a lot of lobbying and a lot of money spent in this town. And Rudy Giuliani was part of that lobbying?
Oh, yes. Rudy Giuliani was paid anywhere from, we think, $25,000 to $40,000 to do some speeches, and may have actually received more money.
To be the pitch man for terrorists who were Muslims.
That's correct. Amazing. That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, his version of loving America and how he was raised, which was to accept a check to support a group,
right,
at that time was on the terrorist list, and he helped to do a lot of lobbying to get him off of there. So I did want to mention
Amazing.
That. But the tone of what he used, Tom, is actually, I mean, it's really unprecedented for a former public official to actually question whether the president, you know, loves this country. So I think that the White House meeting on extremism provided the point that the president needed to make on it. And now he follows up with 60-some nations that are coming together, because this actually is an issue more regionally in the Mideast, obviously, with ISIS and other countries that are involved.
Right.
Which brings us to the issue of Netanyahu, because now the White House has really made it formal and public that they cannot continue to provide information of what's going on in the Iran negotiations, because it's more centered to Netanyahu than it is anything towards Israel. But the fact remains that Netanyahu, they feel, has been able to cherry pick information, put out what he wants to the media, which in fact hurts the Iran-American negotiation talks. So the White House has made it pretty clear that they're going to hold a lot of that information close to the vest, which it should be in private negotiations to try to contain Iran's nuclear.
Do I understand correctly, Congressman, that what has been going on is that Republican members of Congress who are getting top secret briefings from the White House and the administration on these negotiations with Iran have been funneling that information, or at least this is the allegation, that they have funneled that information to Bibi Netanyahu so that he can use it to beat up on the president?
Well, that's correct, and that's the speculation with it, and that Netanyahu has used that information. Netanyahu is in a dead heat. This is not just, you know, the Democratic members deciding not to go see Netanyahu for a speech. I mean, in Israel, he's been in a dead heat because people said, well, the people should still come hear him talk. This is involvement in the election process. So in Israel, it's highly debated about the tactics of how he was invited, because this is where it comes to the chase, Tom.
Right.
John Boehner completely went around any form of protocol. President Obama would not have denied in any stretch or imagination a visit by Bibi Netanyahu to address the Congress. It was the way it was done, and there is a lot of speculation that private information on these talks is leaking out. It's used in the election process. Netanyahu's in a dead heat. So the White House has said these are going to remain private negotiations. It may fail in the talks. It may succeed, but private information never should be leaked out of talks.
Remarkable. What else is up?
The other story we're carrying is the Ferguson story, of course, because the Department of Justice is now going to be into, I almost call it a plea bargain in the sense the Department of Justice is going to sue the city of Ferguson. Ferguson is going to have to come to some terms or face a departmental lawsuit, which they won't want to have from the Department of Justice, and come up to some type of terms about discrimination in the past, how they're going to handle it, how they'll handle it down the road in the future. So, the final on Ferguson is going to come from the Justice Department, and I think there'll be some type of agreement between the two parties before it actually gets to some type of court settlement.
Very interesting.
And then the other thing, the Clinton Foundation, I find this fascinating, but the Clinton Foundation's under a bit of fire. It's from a conservative group who is saying, you know, there's been foreign contributions. That is absolutely nothing new. All presidential foundations have foreign contributions. What they're trying to do, this is a move at trying to get at Hillary Clinton, because they're saying, well, you know, President Clinton's being flown around, former President Clinton's being flown around the world. This is helping Hillary out. So what you're seeing is the stage set of attacking a foundation that does nothing different than the Bush Foundation did. It's because the former president's wife is going to run for office, and that's where this is really coming.
Well, I think there's another piece to this, Bob. It's a little more strategic. The Koch brothers are apparently throwing their lot in with Scott Walker. They've been with him for several years now, which has elevated him to pretty much number one in the Republican presidential list. And if he goes on to be the candidate or even the vice presidential candidate, one of the hits on him is going to be he's got rich backers. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, oh, so does Hillary, her husband and her foundation. And I don't know if it's going to work or not, and it's not even fully true. But I think that's what they're trying to do.
And I agree with you. Walker would never be where he's at without the Koch brothers right now.
There you go. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be with you. On the line with us is State Senator David Zuckerman. He's a state senator in the great state of Vermont, my old home. And the legislature's website is legislature.vermont.gov. Senator Zuckerman, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. I understand that Vermont might be the first state to legalize marijuana, not by citizen petition, which is how it's happened in the four, arguably five states that have done it so far, but by the legislature. Do I have that right?
If we're first to do it, we would be first, clearly. I think it's a little bit of a, quote, race between us, maybe Rhode Island, maybe New York, but I think we've got a solid foothold on the possibility.
I'm assuming that you have strong backing from the citizenry of the state of Vermont?
I think it's a pretty solid support out there. There have been polls over the last number of years showing it. I don't think Vermonters consider marijuana to be in the same class of drugs as some of the more serious drugs that have been causing some real challenges in our society, frankly, across the country, but here in Vermont as well. And folks are ready to see it regulated much more like alcohol.
Yeah, yeah, which is probably a really, really good thing. Where is this legislatively right now in Vermont?
Sure. I introduced the bill earlier this week. It's Bill S-95. It got assigned to the Judiciary Committee. Certainly I've got two of the five votes there, and I'm pretty sure three, which would be ultimately enough, but it's going to take some time. The chairman is cautious about it. We've got some other really big issues around, children and families issues and in Vermont, so he's working on those as higher priorities. But we're laying the groundwork this year, both in that committee, economic development, health, agriculture, government operations. It's actually a topic that has a lot of different committees' purview, and I hope to get some hearings this year to really lay the groundwork for hitting the ground running in January.
Do you see, we have two states right now that have done this and apparently done it well, Washington State and Colorado. And you've got two other states that are in the process, Alaska and Oregon, and then Washington, D.C., that my understanding of what the mayor is telling, Mayor Bowser is telling us here in D.C., pot's going to be legal in another week and a half, but there's no mechanism for selling it or buying it or anything else because Andy Harris and the U.S. House of Representatives has blocked it. But basically, we've got two states that have already set up programs that seem to be working well and two other states that are working on it. Do you have a model in mind, or are you starting this thing from scratch?
Well, certainly looking to many of those states to get an understanding of how it's working and how it isn't. Vermont has one of the more conservative medical use laws, which I think actually sets us up well for the regulated recreational or consumer use side of the equation. Because I think it is working generally well in Colorado, but there are a few glitches. We're looking at things like the edibles, which I think is a very big section of this topic, and making sure that it's child-proof packaging and not appealing to children, not mirroring children's foods like gummy bears.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, I think we're looking at Colorado as clear evidence that the sky doesn't fall, potentially some other drug use goes down. Driving under the influence has not seemed to be a major issue. I talked to my colleagues here and say, what about all the, you know, people are going to drive under the influence? And I remind them that you know, about a tenth of the population is using marijuana each month here in Vermont today, according to the RAND study, and we don't have massive marijuana driving accidents being reported. It's still alcohol, which is a much more serious consequence drug.
Right.
So, you know, we're taking what we can from elsewhere, and we're also putting a Vermont sort of stamp on it as far as how we do things around here fairly sensibly. And, you know, as you know, with some other issues in the past, if we do it well and we lead the way, hopefully some others will follow suit.
Yeah. Were you encouraged by, or did it have any impact in Vermont? I'm curious. The story that was in the Daily Beast last week about the guy who took 90 times the normal adult dose of marijuana just to see what would happen.
Well, I actually hadn't heard about that, although I'm well aware that the whole risk of, quote, overdosing from marijuana is clearly a significantly lower risk than it is from alcohol poisoning or obviously some of the really horrendous drugs that are out there where either because they're laced or because they're stronger than someone thought, you know, they can OD and die.
Yeah.
I think we all pretty well recognize that, you know, sort of the one of the biggest consequences from too much THC is ultimately falling asleep.
That's exactly.
You don't want people falling asleep behind the wheel of a car. That could have a different consequence. But
right.
That, you know, whether it be the Maureen Dowd scenario, which also got a lot of news, you know, making sure people know how much to use. And I think those are some of the lessons from Colorado that folks who recreationally use today illegally might know how much to use or how much not to use. But we have a pretty large population that may choose to try it once, just like they go have a beer once in a while, but
sure.
Not really know how much they're supposed to have. So we want to make sure there's good information for people so that they don't have bad experiences.
Yeah. Just FYI, this was a hysterical story. This guy, he went to Denver. 10 milligrams of pot of THC is a very strong intoxicating dose, right? That's, you know, if you really want to get high, you hit 10 milligrams. And you can buy 10 milligram chocolates, one dose chocolates. And he bought 90 of them and ate them all at once, thinking that he was going to write the great Hunter S. Thompson Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas novel about bats flying out of the sky and carrying him away or something. And what happened was he got somewhat high for a few minutes, said, oh, yeah, I recognize this. I'm really stoned. And then he fell asleep for 17 hours.
So I was going to say, he probably was out for quite a while.
Yeah, 900 milligrams of THC. 10 milligrams is an effective dose. That really, 2 or 3 milligrams is an effective dose. 10 milligrams is a high dose. 10 milligrams
right.
is maybe the equivalent of 2 glasses of wine if you want to make an alcohol comparison, or maybe even 3. And he took 90 times that. If you did that with alcohol, you'd be so
right.
dead.
So, well, and I look at issues like around domestic violence around the Super Bowl, which we all know is unfortunately, while it's a great game, it's one of the hardest day on women in our society. And a lot of that's around alcohol.
Yeah.
And most people I know, granted, sometimes they're joking about it, sometimes they're serious, but the real bottom line is you see a lot less violence from people who are high on marijuana as opposed to alcohol.
Well, Colorado has seen this. They've actually seen their violent crime rate go down since they decriminalized pot, and they've seen their alcohol abuse rate go down.
Well, that's exactly right. And I've also been talking with some of my colleagues here in the legislature to say, you know, most industries and businesses in society pay taxes for the greater good of society, whether it be roads or it be, you know, social services, et cetera. We have a whole market that's happening today, and they're not actually paying their fair share. So it's again, not as if we're creating something new. We're just simply changing how it's regulated and seen in our society. And actually, I've been getting reasonably good conversations with a lot of my colleagues. The reception's been better than I expected.
Yeah, I think what's happening is that, A, people are realizing that they got snookered. We all got snookered back in the 30s into thinking that a relatively benign weed was some sort of evil drug. And B, the rise of the libertarian strain within the Republican Party is fracturing that right-wing caucus that used to just be a wall of opposition to pot, and the libertarians are going, hey, you know, it's pot. It's not a big deal. It's, you know, freedom works kind of thing. You know?
Well, I agree, and I think ultimately people are ahead of the curve once again on this, just as they showed in Colorado and other states where when it was offered up as a referendum, it's been passing.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes politicians, we tend to be a more cautious bunch because you don't want to get a reactionary throw the bums out kind of situation. I'm a little less cautious than some of my colleagues on any number of issues, whether it was marriage equality or GMO labeling, et cetera. But so a lot of people expected that I would do this. But, you know, we've done medical use here. We've decriminalized it here. And the colleagues of mine that are still here have said those weren't major problems for their constituents. And so I think that's one of the reasons we have a possibility of doing it here as well. We're relatively small state, relatively directly connected with our constituents. And
that's great. State Senator David Zuckerman of the great state of Vermont. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for having me.
Great talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, pot decriminalization coming to a town near you? Who knows? Next week in D.C. is going to be fascinating. We'll be back. Welcome back. James in Spokane, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, James, what's on your mind? James, you are on the air. I think James is listening to his TV instead of his telephone. And there's about a 30-second delay between the two. Let's try Eric in Atlanta, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Can you hear me, Eric?
Yes, I can, Tom.
Great. You're on the air. What's up?
I want to thank you for your public service here. I'm a recently new viewer, and I'm just very, very impressed with, I guess, your intelligence and your ability to communicate on these issues.
Well, thank you, Eric. What's on your mind?
I had a comment about Rudy Giuliani and his Giuliani Associates. It's my impression that he dropped out of his presidential bid, or one of the main reasons was his largest customer, Giuliani Associates, was his Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the maker of oxycodone, the widely abused painkiller. They knew many of their, or a high percentage of their prescriptions were being illegally used, and they never wanted to put it in a form, whereas when the kids crushed it, they wouldn't get high off it.
Right.
So groups such as MAD, parents who had lost their children to the abuse, which is just tremendous, the number of deaths from the abuse of the drug, were about to come forward and talk about Giuliani Associates and the fact that they, again, it's been their largest, it was Giuliani Associates' largest client always to keep the drug on the market in its form, the highly abused form. Okay. So, I just found that shocking.
Well, not only that, who did he hire as the head of the New York City Police Department? Bernard Kerik? Isn't Bernard Kerik in jail right now? And this was the guy that he wanted, that the Bush was going to make the attorney general or something?
Let's not start talking about the individuals who Giuliani chooses to associate himself with.
Right.
Someone like Billy Fugazi, Fugazi Travel Limo, when convicted of felonious bankruptcy fraud, produced a letter from the Pope saying he's innocent, but the court didn't go for that. But unfortunately, like that supermarket character, John Kasem, whatever you mentioned earlier on your show or yesterday on your show, they got presidential pardons from Bill Clinton, which was so sad.
Yeah.
those last minute pardons, Fugazi got one of those.
Oh, really? So pardons for sale to rich folks. I mean, there's nothing new about that, but it's unfortunate to hear.
Folks. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Connected. If you're friends with these politicians, somehow they'll get you what.
Right. Or if you give them enough money, and that's the real sad thing in this society. If you give them enough money, they will do what you want, and it's just that is not
in
how
what's happened to our democracy. Yeah.
Right. That's not how democracy should work.
No, not at all. It's so sad, and particularly our legal system.
Yeah.
It is so stacked. You don't get your day in court. You're summarily charged against preventing you from your day in court if you have the proper connections and proper money.
Yep.
So it's so sad.
Elizabeth Warren was right. The game is rigged. It is rigged for the rich, for the powerful, and by and large for the white. Eric, thank you very much for the call. And the mail, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and I was going to say, I was going to pick up some phone calls here. I still have about 25 articles that I that I wanted to share with you. Oh man, I had told you a couple of weeks ago that some of these new smart TVs listen into your house constantly, and according to the terms and conditions that come along with them, they send everything that they hear to a third party. Now, they're continuously listening to hear if you say, turn the TV off, turn to channel 7, turn to channel 22, turn the volume up, turn the volume down. That's what the TV is listening for. But it's actually hearing everything you say. This in BBC Today, from Leo Kellyan, the technology desk editor. This is Samsung has acknowledged that some of its smart TV models are uploading their owners' voices to the Internet in an unencrypted form. The matter was brought to the public's attention by UK-based cybersecurity experts. Samsung says that they are going to release new code that would encrypt the voice commands to protect its users. Not so good. Meanwhile, Lenovo, I remember, you know, I used to have IBM PC laptops. IBM made it one of the early laptops it had. Didn't have a trackpad. It had this little button in the middle of the keyboard. And I really liked that laptop. It was one of the better DOS laptops that I had in my life. And then IBM sold their laptop division, and I think their entire computer division, but certainly their laptop division, to a Chinese company, to Lenovo. And I was like, okay, I'm not buying these anymore. Not to say I don't buy anything made in China. I'm using Apple products now, and they're all made in China. But, you know, the Lenovo thing was a Chinese company. It was a bridge too far for me. Now, again, from BBC News, their technology section, Jane Wakefield writing, the headline, Lenovo taken to task over malicious adware. Computer maker Lenovo has been forced to remove hidden adware that it was shipping on its laptops and PCs after users expressed anger. The adware, dubbed Superfish, was potentially compromising their security, said experts. The hidden software is also injecting advertisements onto browsers using techniques more akin to malware, they added. Lenovo faces questions about why and for how long it was pre-installed on machines and what data was collected. Right. It's pretty breathtaking how powerful and how extraordinarily, you know, the depth and breadth of corporate control of our lives and our privacy has become. This is the essence. This is the key to the whole thing. Americans don't understand this. But the key to the whole thing is running the game. Not just playing the game, but running the game. You know, in Vegas, they say the house always wins, no matter what. The odds are always that, you know, no matter how much money goes through a casino, between 1% and 3% of it is going to end up sticking to the casino. It's just, you know, hey, there's those two green balls on roulette, or there's that, you know, you can only double down up to the house limit with the blackjack, or yeah, name your game. This is the same thing that big corporations are doing and billionaires in our political process right now. This is what the Vice President of the United States spoke about when he said they claim to be super patriots. They demand free enterprise, but they're the spokesman for monopoly. Their final objective is to capture political power so that using the state of the power and the power of the market simultaneously, the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. The only agency, as it were, the only group that is strong enough to prevent a Lenovo from putting spyware into our computers before they even arrive here. The only agency that is strong enough to prevent Koch Industries refineries or Georgia-Pacific paper mills from pouring more poison into the air than they're putting, and the water than they're putting right now, is government. You can't do it. I can't do it. There is no organized consumer movement in the United States anymore. Unions are down to the point where they really can't do anything other than represent the workers that they represent. So what we're left with is corporate rule. Corporate rule, and like, you know, hey, here it is. You don't have a choice. You don't know what's in your food. You don't know if it's genetically modified or not. The corporations who own our politicians will not allow those politicians to require those corporations to disclose to you if there's genetically modified ingredients in your food. They will not allow those politicians to require the food corporations to disclose to you if there are other ingredients in their food that might be harmful to you. What level of pesticide residue is in the meal that you ate last night? There's no way to know. Because every time politicians get together and say, hey, you know, maybe people should know this, the industry says, no, you can't do that. And we're industry. We run politics in the United States. We have reached the point. This is what Benito Mussolini called fascism. We have reached the point where there are very few politicians in the United States who are willing, much less able, to stand up to billionaires or big corporations. Just can't do it. There's a reason why no banksters have gone to jail. If Holder had been sending banksters to jail, the banksters would be funding Republican attacks on the Obama administration. It's not to say Holder shouldn't be sending banksters to jail, but the point is that the banksters are actually stronger than the White House. The food industry is stronger than Congress. The drug industry is stronger than Congress. The tobacco industry is even stronger than Congress. And it's astonishing. When are we going to wake up and say, no?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Actually, more importantly, when are we going to wake up and say the only power that can hold back these billionaires and corporations is the power of government, and we're going to invest in that? 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. Reading the drugpolicy.org blog of the Drug Policy Alliance, they are pointing out, and it's republished over on Alternate, that we have a new drug czar. Did you know this? For a lot of us, it just kind of slipped right through the cracks. We've got a brand new drug czar. His name is Botticelli. Where's his first name? I don't see his first name. That's totally strange. The drug czar, doesn't have his name under his picture. Come on, where is it? Michael Botticelli. There we go. Maybe I'm mispronouncing. Maybe it's Botticelli. I don't know. But he has come out in favor of improved access to naloxone, which is the stuff that can prevent narcotic overdoses from killing people. He's promoted Good Samaritan laws, so if somebody witnesses a drug overdose and calls 911, they don't go to jail, even if they're holding or were involved. He's announced a new policy barring federal funding for drug courts that don't allow participation in medication-assisted treatment programs. He was the first drug czar to say that if Washington, D.C. passes a ballot measure legalizing pot, hey, they should be allowed to do that. This is pretty amazing stuff. Anyway, just FYI. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Well, you're talking a lot today about the effects of Citizens United and changing,
yes,
promoting the general welfare of we the people to making profits for the corporations and the 1%.
Yep.
And brings me to my question, Tom. If you look at what Ryan's proposing, his tax plan would take billions of dollars from the middle class and transfer it to the rich. And the only way the Republicans can get in office, is it their hatred for President Obama, or is he just in the way because the only way they can win is with war?
Yeah. I don't know if the only way they can win is with war, but I do know that the only way that the Republicans can win any election anytime is by slicing and dicing the electorate into a whole bunch of special interest categories, the fundamentalist Christian special interests, the anti-abortion special interests, the anti-women in general special interests, the white folks only special interests, the bigot special interests, the obviously the corporatist, although that's a much smaller group, the people who hate unions, they've been able to indoctrinate some people. Whether that's, what their problem with Obama is, I don't know. But I think you've nailed it, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. Deb in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Deb, what's up?
In Milwaukee. Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call. Of course, I'm a fourth generation Wisconsinite and a retired teacher and counselor. So Governor Walker, his decisions having to do with public education, gutting funding for it, and wanting to expand vouchers and charter schools is distressing. But I'm even more concerned now that he's going after our university system.
Yeah.
You're probably aware that the University of Wisconsin's system, he wants $300 million slashed from that.
Right, so that he can have tax cuts for rich people and corporations. Yeah.
Right. But even more, you were talking about the role of corporations. I wonder if corporations are soon going to control our educational system. In the UW system, there's something called the Wisconsin Idea. It's the mission statement.
Right.
And Governor Walker, he says that it was a mistake, but he wanted to cut from the mission statement of the system. I don't have the exact phrase, but it is basic to every purpose of this system is the pursuit of truth, public service, and improving the common good, where he kept in meeting the needs of the state's workforce.
Right.
Anything having to do with getting, employees to work for the corporations. And there's been quite an outcry here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
On this. He's backing off from it, though.
Yeah. Well, and he's backing off because it's just words. But if it's something like actually breaking a union, he did not back off. He won that battle.
I know.
Yeah. Deb, Shano tells me that you are the winner today of a copy of one of my books, your choice of either a paperback Crash of 2016 or a paperback Death in the Pines. So would you like a free book?
Yes, it sounds wonderful.
Okay.
I'm all for books.
Okay. Let me put you on hold. Deb's online too, Danielle. And Danielle will get your address, and I'll autograph it and send it off to you. And thank you for that. Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up? Tim, can you hear me? Okay, I'm going to put Tim on hold here, and we'll see what's going on. Philip in Eugene, Oregon. Philip, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you're on the air, sir. Thank you for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Well, let's see. I've smoked marijuana since I was 13, and I'm 53 now. And I never thought I could overdose on marijuana. But we were, we were smoking oil.
Uh-huh.
We were doing dabs, which is where you have an instrument and you put it onto the end of it and you put it in a very hot bowl.
Right.
And you smoke it.
Okay? Yeah, never tried that.
I did only 150 milligrams.
150 milligrams?
Yeah, that's all I did.
Well, that's 10 times the normal dose.
Yes.
Okay.
I just didn't see it coming. I didn't think I was going to throw up horribly bad.
Yeah.
Dry heaves for 2 hours.
Oh, it made you sick, huh?
Very sick.
That's unfortunate.
As sick as I could have been drinking alcohol, for sure. Spinning. That was outside of his house. I threw up all over his backyard.
Oh, my. Well, here's the thing, Philip. If you had drank enough alcohol to get you that intoxicated, you would have damaged both your liver and your brain. Taking that much pot might have intoxicated you that much, but there's pretty much no evidence that it damaged your brain or your liver. So, and the proof of it is that you're here on the phone talking to me. So, interesting war story. Thanks a lot for the call, Philip. Tim in Ann Arbor. You want to try it again, Tim? Tim is not there. Okay. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Charles.
Gotta say, I love your show. I've been listening to you all week.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for everything that you do. But my biggest thing that I had to just let off my chest is I believe that conservatives, these Republicans, they're actually jealous of all of the carnage and bloodshed that's happening overseas, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's in Ukraine, or anywhere else across the world, and they want to get America involved. I think they're just itching for a fight that President Obama and the rest of all of America, the rest of Americans, don't want to get into. Basically, we haven't been hit over here in America by any terrorist acts. All of these things are happening in Iraq, which we were wrong to destabilize that country in the very first place under false premises.
Yep.
And, you know, basically, they're trying to push us back into this war by fear. With Fox News and the rest of whether it's the House or the Senate, you know, and we can't let this happen. If anything, I'm not worried about World War III. I'm not worried about going to war because I believe in this president. Mm. I believe everything that they've thrown at him has not worked. And even right now with Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm really hoping that the Israelis over there can decipher between what's going on and get rid of him. Because basically, all of these conservatives are on a warpath. They see what that guy Putin has done, and they want to get into this, you know, this bloodshed and carnage as well. And America cannot afford to go back into a war because it's actually going to regress all the gains that we've made economically.
Yeah, I'm with you, Charles. And we actually are in the middle of several wars, and we've created a fairly bad situation in Libya as well. And it's like, you know, where we go from here. I don't disagree with your comments about President Obama. I have a high level of faith and trust in him as well. That said, he's only going to be president for another year and three quarters. And it's you've got a Republican House and a Republican Senate. This is a critical time for American democracy. This is absolutely the time that everybody needs to be getting involved in political activity, showing up at the local Democratic Party meetings, participating in whatever way they can, because we are at a turning point. We are at one of those great 80-year historic turning points. We're also at a more micro turning point, but this is it. These are the important times. And Charles, you nailed it, why it's so important. Thank you for the call. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Yeah, you had a very smart caller about an hour ago who pointed out some of the Republican lies. I've noticed if you take the exact opposite of what Republicans say, you get the truth. Here are a few examples. Obama doesn't love America. Republicans really don't love America. They only love billionaires. Republicans say Obamacare had death panels. Well, the Republicans and the insurance companies are the real death panels. And the Republicans say billionaires are job creators, where they're actually just job killers who suck trillions of dollars out of our economy and stuff it into Swiss bank accounts, the Cayman Islands. And another one was, before the Iraq War, remember, they were all saying, we have to start this war so we can achieve peace.
Right.
We have to start a war to achieve peace.
Right.
I don't think Obama's going to start another war. I don't think he's going to fall for it. I think he's going to hold the line, just airstrikes, you know.
We'll see. And I hope you're right, Paul. I really do. And ISIS is doing everything they can to desperately try to engage us, to establish legitimacy, and thank you, Paul, for the call. And Fox so-called news and hate radio in America, and there are these so-called right-wing politicians, so-called conservative politicians. They are all doing their very best to give ISIS exactly what they want, which is suggesting that somehow they are legitimately Muslim when they are not.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
These guys are not Muslims. They are blasphemers. They are apostates, if I'm saying that word right. They are violating Islam. Welcome back. James in Spokane, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, James, what's up?
Yes, Tom, great job. Well, what the guy just said, this is what I called about, so if you give me a couple of topics. But anyway, drones and airstrikes for Obama, he's doing the best he can to hold back the tide, but those are certainly going to accelerate. You can't do that stuff and it not accelerate. But also I want to speak to the fact that we're a warrior nation and we glorify that. Show business does that, and to a great extent we accept it because we don't have the bombs falling in our backyard. We have secondary collateral damage,
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah, we had, the last time we had a war, on our soil was the Civil War, and the one before that was the War of 1812. And basically, the generation that fought the War of 1812 was dying out about the time the Civil War started, just like the generation that fought World War II is dying out right now. And that takes us back to Toynbee's comment that, you know, when the generation that remembers the horrors of the last Great War dies, the next Great War becomes inevitable. Now, I think you're absolutely right. We glorify war in this country. We make movies about it. We sing songs about it, you know, through the, you know, bombs bursting light and all that kind of thing. It's part of our national anthem.
Let me mention the CIA as well.
Sure.
We forget them at our peril at every turn. They are the great exacerbators. They're the ones advising the executive. They're the ones causing this all over the world, often with false flag operations. And also, they're the largest drug cartel in the world.
Well, that was certainly true during the Reagan administration, whether it's still the case.
Look, they transport with immunity. Yeah. Nobody checks their cargo. They already operate with a black budget that's discretionary, and they create their own with the drug war.
James, I completely agree that the CIA needs more oversight and greater transparency. What I can't say is that I know what their crimes are, because I don't. But certainly they have done those things. I mean, it's fairly clear during the Reagan era that the CIA was involved in smuggling drugs, or at least the Reagan administration was, and bringing crack cocaine to our nation's cities. And it was a terrible thing. James, thanks for the call. Jim in Hobart, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. One of the topics you covered today was Governor Scott Walker, and I live in a neighboring state, Indiana, which has embraced the right to work policy that Governor Walker is so famous for.
Right, you got Mike Pence, right?
That is correct.
Former right-wing talk show host. Boy, is he a piece of work.
He is really a piece of work. Now, very close friends of mine work for a union outfit that makes principal parts for Harley-Davidson motorcycle that was recently moved here to Indiana for the sole purpose of going non-union.
Wow.
And it's just a little disconcerting that something that is so emblematic to so many as an American product like Harley-Davidson, that this has gone on and gone unnoticed. Right. I hadn't heard no mention of this.
It's gone unnoticed because all the big media organizations are either in the process of getting rid of their unions or are non-union to begin with.
So true.
I mean, no, I'm serious. In network television, there are wars going on over unionization right now as we speak. And so they're not going to be talking about unions on the air much at all. You know, with the single exception of Ed Schultz, who does a marvelous job with his stuff and on these topics, you just never hear about it. And that's why, I believe that's why. I could be wrong, but I believe that's why. Jim, thanks for the call. And thanks for reminding us of the good little Mr. Pence's proclivities. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Zach in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Zach, you know, when that caller who called in who said he took 150 milligrams of THC and then ended up barfing all over the place, I just have to say, the first time I smoked pot, I was 15 years old. I spent the better part of 40 years probably not smoking it at all. But, you know, I have a fair amount of experience with pot and a lot of other drugs, and I've never heard a story like that. You have an explanation for why he was so sick, Zach?
Well, I mean, yeah, you can smoke yourself sick. Sure, that's possible. But the problem with a lot of the oils and what they're calling waxes nowadays,
right?
It's not the fact that you're getting sick on the pot or the cannabis. It's the solvents that are being used. And most people who are doing this, they're not chemists. It's just somebody, you know, messing around in their house. And especially the stuff they're calling wax. It's compressed butane gas that they use to make an isomerization of the THC.
Wow.
And most people cannot get that out. So part of what you're smoking is butane. And in the case of oils, it can be anything from, you know, Everclear to acetone.
Right.
So really the point I wanted to make was that Mother Nature had it right. And the more people mess around with this stuff, the more you're going to see.
Right. So what we should do is just make tea or just smoke it or vape it or put it into brownies and cookies.
Yeah, that's great. Eating it is perfectly fine. You're not going to have problems there. Or buy it from someone who actually
you know, from the legal stores where you have a chemist who's actually able to distill it, to refine it, and maybe even put it through spectral analysis. But, but you know, just some ghetto chemist sitting at their house running butane gas through the cannabis, it's...
Right. And odds are they're not even in the ghetto. They're probably in a middle-class white suburb if they're doing what you're just describing. But, yeah, I get it. I get it, Zach. Thank you. That's very informative. I hadn't considered that. Peter, driving through Indiana. Hey, Peter. Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hey,
what's up?
I'm actually South Carolina today.
Okay. So what's on your mind?
I have a few things. Well, actually, what that guy just said, I don't know much about the butane, but I was a manufacturer of a spice product.
Uh-huh.
Was when you could still buy the chemical legally. And as far as acetone evaporates completely. The only way you could get anything from acetone is if you did it when it was wet. And it would more than likely kill you if you actually smoked acetone.
Yeah, acetone's pretty poisonous stuff.
It is, but it evaporates completely. The only thing it's left behind is the water that they dilute it with.
Right, but apparently that's not the case with butane. Butane seems to be the big thing that they're using to dissolve out THC.
I think butane does the same thing. I just have zero experience with it, so I wouldn't speak on it.
Okay.
That's just what I do. As far as the people, when they keep bringing up this argument of the people driving around stone,
right.
Forgive me if I get the name wrong because I'm driving, so I don't have access to the Internet at the moment, but it's the National Highway Traffic Safety Board just released a study that they updated. They've been doing this for a very long time on alcohol and prescription drugs and things like that. And driving stoned, you are no more likely to get in an accident than driving sober, is what the study says.
Yeah, but
there actually is no real threat of people driving around stoned. That's why you don't have examples over the decades of stoned people being in accidents. Whenever they bring up marijuana in an accident situation, it's generally not the only thing. It's usually alcohol plus, plus.
Right, or it's, and marijuana was found on the scene, but it wasn't, causal. Yeah, in fact, people, whether they're driving or whether they're walking, when they're fairly high on pot, they tend to be slower and more careful. Now, you could say that of a drunk, who's walking along kind of slurring and trying to, but, a drunk doesn't have the capacity to be more careful, in my experience. I don't know. So that's, I saw that study, Peter. You're right. And it's fascinating stuff. And as this becomes legal, more and more, we're going to have, more and more. It won't just be anecdotal data. It'll actually be solid data. We'll have good epidemiological studies that we can look at, or good long-term longitudinal studies. Thank you for the call, Peter. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, Scott Walker went after the disabled people?
Yeah. This is a message for Beth Sweden, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She says it seems a surprise to everybody that managed care organizations, other programs and participants, that nobody knew it was coming. I knew it was coming because the overarching thing is they want to get rid of the ADA.
What's so the it that was coming, Catherine?
Well, that there would be cuts, that there would be problems, that they were going to start reducing services or make it more difficult or privatize.
Uh-huh.
It was obvious to me, with everything I've talked to you about and seen over the last 2 years, and one or two times I tried to talk to people with disabilities, they didn't want to hear it. Or I talked about, the estate tax recovery, and they were saying, oh, no, that wouldn't happen, and they kind of had their heads in the sand, so I didn't continue telling people. Mm. He's getting rid of he's proposing cuts and changes to the at-home care services, and he's taking away oversight for and regulation, which means that privatized managed care organizations could come from out of the state.
Hmm.
And this will lead to the possibility of maybe essential care like bathing and feeding that some people need to stay independent will not happen. And Beth expresses surprise that since it's a working system, why are they doing this?
Well, it's
so,
because it's a working system.
Hello?
I said it's because it's a working system. That's the Republican strategy. If you find any part of government that's working well, like the post office in 2006, it was showing such a large profit, they were talking about putting half their fleet of cars as electric cars. As soon as you see a government agency that's working well, destroy it. And so, they poison-pilled the post office in 2006 with that law saying they had to set aside $5 billion a year for retirees who haven't even been born yet. So, Walker looking at an agency that serves the disabled in Wisconsin that's doing a good job and saying, ha-ha, let's destroy that. That makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah, to us and the disability community has to understand it's time to get out right now.
Get out? What do you mean?
Get out
of the state?
And talk to your legislator. find out that this is going to happen and not be in denial.
Get out and get active. Yeah, I got it. Catherine, brilliant. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Thank you all so much for being with us today. It's been an amazing day. I will be back in the chat room tomorrow, I promise. We're in a computer hell here, what can I say? Anyhow, thanks so much. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You actually have to show up. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.